Welcome to this week's Current Federal Tax Developments, brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, coming to you from here in Phoenix at my office. We're going to talk this week about a few developments that took place in taxes. We have two developments in the area of state sales taxes and the tattletale style laws. We get to find out how Colorado's initial reporting period went and what they found out, as well as discover that Oklahoma wasn't done with tattletale laws. After passing one, they've got another. The IRS goes ahead and patches a problem that was caused by the change in the inflation adjustment factor. We'll talk about that relief we got. We have a chief counsel advice that took a look at volunteers who divided the amounts in a tip jar at the end of the day. And the IRS's conclusion that those taxpayers, well, they're subject to FICA, that there's a FICA reporting obligation inherent in that. So that'll be one of those things. And we'll also discover a new TurboTax issue, shall we say. You know, we've had the TurboTax defense in the past, which hasn't worked well for taxpayers. This time, it's not really a TurboTax defense. It's, well, they tried something, saying, well, they didn't make it really clear to me. The theory didn't get far. Taxpayer never checked to find out that his return had been rejected almost immediately upon submission. And he's trying to argue his way out of the late filing penalty, as we'll discover. That also didn't work. Well, we're here nice into the early spring. And if you're listening to this before the end of April, yeah, we're just almost done with the end of tax season month. If you're listening to it on Tuesday or later, you're now into May. And so we're going to be taking a look. And as we were aware, a couple weeks ago, we discussed the fact that the Supreme Court heard the arguments in the Wayfair case. But in addition to that whole discussion about whether states have the right to force an outside seller to collect their sales tax, we have the issue of dealing with this on this secondary track, the issue of disclosure rules that are based on Colorado's law. And that's kind of an interesting point because that particular law is one that has passed muster. The Tenth Circuit approved it. The Supreme Court did not hear the appeal of the Tenth Circuit's case. And one of the judges who wrote a concurring opinion in the Tenth Circuit case upholding Colorado's law is now sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court and, in fact, brought up the Colorado option. It was brought up multiple times in the discussions on Wayfair. So one question you may have now is, how is that Colorado law working? This week, tax analysts had in Tax Notes Today a report of comments from Phil Horowitz, which is from the Colorado Department of Revenue. And he gave comments to the Multi-State Tax Commission's Uniformity Committee. And what he discussed in this case was, you know, how the reporting had gone. And I think I have him misspelled on the slide. If you look at the slides this week, and by the way, yes, they're a little different this week because we are switching over to the Kaplan Accounting Continuing Education standard slides for this session. So you're going to be seeing things a little different. We have the official right color, right shade of purple. Always important to have the right color in there. So we're set. And I think it's Mr. Horowitz, not Horowitz. So I apologize to Phil for the misspelling of his name on the slide. Nevertheless, it's spelled correctly, I believe, if you take a look in the printed materials we've got on the website. We talked about how the Colorado rule worked. Colorado approached its first reporting period. This law took effect on July 1st of 2017. The first reports were due in by March 1st of 2018. So obviously that leads to a question. What happened? For those who don't recall, on Colorado's law, if you clear their minimum sales number, you're required to send to the state of Colorado a report every year, among other things, that tells the state who bought from you and how much they bought, right? You send the same information to your customers so they, in theory, can then file a use tax report with the state of Colorado. Well, the state of Colorado, you know, had been expecting this to raise some significant funds. And in one sense, you initially read about it and you say, well, they got a report on 800,000 people. And that's fine, except we think there probably are more than 800,000 people that bought things over the internet or mail order from the state, you know, who live in the state of Colorado who failed to pay use tax. I would probably say there's a good chance that maybe at least 3/4 of the people in Colorado probably would fit the category of having failed to file their use tax return and having bought goods from, you know, from outside the state, for which no use tax was paid. So Colorado, now maybe they all bought it from small sellers who, you know, only sold less than, as I recall, the Colorado limit is 100,000 into the state of Colorado, but that also seems unlikely. And in fact, Colorado Department of Revenue believes that number is low. They reported a total of $250 million in purchases. That's also well below what the state of Colorado believed exists in these outside of state sales into the state of Colorado, for which no sales or use tax is being paid. That would end up with, if these were all fully subject to Colorado sales tax, or Colorado use tax, really, in this case, that would amount to $7.5 million approximately in tax to the state of Colorado. However, Colorado outside sellers who report to the state of Colorado are not required to determine if an item is taxable in Colorado. And I would tell you, and I would strongly suspect, that the vast majority are going to say, I'm not about to go into that quagmire. I was just looking this morning at Arizona's list of what's includable or excludable for the Arizona's transaction privilege tax or sales tax equivalent. And it is an insanely complicated list of items that are or aren't taxable and various things. And that ignores the whole fact that in Arizona, you'd have to also consider all the localities that may claim a right to tax it. So nobody, if they can get out of it, is going to worry about trying to figure out if something is or is not taxable when they sell into the state. Because I'll also guarantee you another thing. Despite the fact Arizona and Colorado are both Four Corners states, I'll guarantee you Colorado's list of what is and isn't taxable is not going to be the same as Arizona's. So probably some part of that $250 million worth of purchases is not subject to Colorado sales tax, so the actual uncollected tax would be less than $7.5 million. Mr. Horwitz, when discussing this, indicated that the state considered these numbers to be disappointing. He did say the stats they got, the largest single buyer that was reported, and again, didn't say in the article whether this was from multiple sellers reporting about this same buyer or whether it was all one buy, but $900,000 was the amount purchased by one particular, either taxpayer in Colorado, that could have been a business, it could have been an individual, and the next highest number was $300,000. We had one seller reported 115,000 different people buying in the state that they reported on. Now, that gives you some ideas about the numbers you might have to do. I would assume that 115,000 would be a large seller, something like, hey, Wayfair, you know, could be one of those sellers that had 115,000 people buying in the state of Colorado from them. He did report, so Mr. Horwitz decided that the state still believes it has work to do to inform out-of-state sellers about their obligation. In essence, he thinks, and he's probably correct, that a lot of people selling into Colorado have no idea this rule exists. I would say they have no idea the rules exist in all the other states for which there are similar rules. And some of those states include Vermont, Washington, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Rhode Island, Oklahoma. You know, those states also have a reporting, this kind of turn in your customer reporting statute. This will be interesting. If, in fact, the Supreme Court decides to not overturn Quill, and, of course, a lot of people listening to their oral arguments, again, that's always dangerous to try to reason from the oral arguments to figure out how the court's going to go. But a lot of people who listened to it got very concerned that, wait, you know, if you're a state that wanted overturned, that it wasn't the slam dunk they're going to overturn Quill that some people thought it was when the court took on this case. If the court leaves Quill in place, which there definitely were justices who were suggesting that might be the smartest thing to do, in essence, leave it up to Congress, and Congress may have spoken because they haven't done anything. They may just like the current system. It's pretty clear the Colorado-style statute works, and I think if, in fact, the Supreme Court does not overturn Quill, we're going to see a lot more Colorado-style statutes. Now, the key is going to be how are the states going to get the word out, and how aggressive are they going to be on the enforcement end? Well, the fact that Colorado's results are disappointing has not stopped other states from adding. And in fact, Oklahoma decided to double down on the issue. Oklahoma has slowly been running in and bringing in this sort of tattletale statute. And I called it a tattletale statute. I'm sure the states do not like me referring to it that way. But that's what I consider, in essence, turn in your customer statute. So, you know, tattle on them. Hey, these guys aren't paying use tax. That's what you're supposed to do. So Oklahoma's doubling down. Now, Oklahoma has required now for a while that if you sell in Oklahoma, you had to, and you weren't collecting the sales or use tax, you're supposed to report to your customers the fact that they bought from you and they owe Oklahoma use tax. But under the old law, you didn't have to actually tell the state of Oklahoma about your customers. Well, Oklahoma just passed a law that will effectively change that. In essence, Oklahoma Senate Bill 337 issued on April the 23rd of 2018. That particular bill will require vendors now not only to report to the customer that they have, you know, that they had basically a sale that's subject to use tax, but they also have to tell the Oklahoma Tax Commission that these are the people that bought from us. Interesting enough, this law does not appear to have a de minimis number. It does have a $100,000 limitation rule in it, but that rule only says that vendors that sell $100,000 in the state of Oklahoma may be required to submit that information electronically to the Oklahoma Tax Commission. But it does not say that those who are under 100 grand are not required to submit it in some form. So it appears everybody has to report to the state of Oklahoma. The rule also provides penalties. Now, these penalties are not that bad. They are a per return. They're more in line with failure to file information returns. They are not like Washington's draconian penalties for not following the rules. But they are penalties that could be picked up. And if you have a low margin product that you're not selling for much, you know, a $5 per return per report penalty could very well wipe out your profit selling into Oklahoma. So you need to worry about that in some case. Now, this was in addition to the marketplace law we discussed a couple of weeks ago that Oklahoma passed. Now, as of the time this is recorded, this was on the governor's desk to be signed. I have not been able to determine if the governor has actually signed this bill. The governor did sign the earlier bill, so let us assume that the governor probably will sign this one. It appears to have passed overwhelmingly through the Oklahoma legislature, and it's just the obvious extension to what Oklahoma had been doing before. So don't be surprised if we see more of these tattletales. Now, if the Supreme Court decides to overturn Quill, then I think we have a very different situation on our hands. Then we'll see states probably try to move to collection statutes, and the Colorado-style statute will fall to the wayside. But again, if the Supreme Court does not overturn Quill, it's not like, oh, happy day, nothing has changed. What we're going to see almost for certain is a great expansion, and probably eventually every state will adopt a tattletale statute. That's simply the obvious response of the states, especially any state that has currently made any move to try to collect on out-of-state sales. Next up, we have a little issue that was one of those created by Congress's Tax Cuts and Jobs Act change, but it wasn't obvious at the initial point of what the problem would be, and then we finally figured out what it was. So in Revenue Procedure 2018-27, issued on April the 25th, the IRS took care of a problem that was created by the fact that under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, inflation adjustments were to be calculated using the chain CPI rather than the standard CPI for urban consumers. And Congress, and this is where the problems arose, did not say that would only apply for numbers we're going to compute for inflation adjustments for 2019 and later, but they made it apply to 18 numbers. Those 18 numbers had already been released by the IRS. And in fact, in the case of the contributions to high deductible health plans, under the law, they're supposed to be released early in the year before. So the number of what the contribution could be if you had a family, you know, so you had family coverage, HDHP family coverage, you're contributing to your health savings account or your employer is putting money in the health savings account. Under the numbers that were released back last year in Revenue Procedure 2017-37, the number said you could contribute $6,900. Now, your employer may have put that in your account at the beginning of the year. You might have made choices in your cafeteria plan to defer that amount this year, various things, or maybe you contributed your own money already into the account. And then the IRS came out in Revenue Procedure 2827. and gave us new inflation adjusted numbers. And something people noticed right away, that family HDHP number dropped by $50. So your number is $6,850 rather than $6,900. Well, that's a problem because now you're over-contributed. Over-contributing to a health savings account creates a problem that you're going to be hit with an excise tax if it's over-contributed at the end of the year. So the problem is now you might have to reach in and try to take that 50 out. So maybe now you've taken that 50 back out. Okay, well, that's fine. Except now the IRS says, and many people though haven't, they just have 6,900, or it may be that deferral they have no way of changing that's going to be too high. So the IRS announced in Revenue Procedure 28727 that, okay, despite the fact 6,850 should be the number this year, we're going to go ahead and let people contribute 6,900. We're just going to ignore the fact that Congress said it had to apply to 18. And I have a feeling Congress is not going to worry terribly about the IRS ignoring the language of the law. In essence, by the way, and I think it's unfortunate, but Congress has gotten used to the IRS bailing out their, shall we say, lack of foresight in writing law issues they create, which is this is one of them. I'm not personally very thrilled when the IRS does this, and I've not been thrilled, but they've been doing it for a long time under Congress's controlled by both parties. So this is just a long time Congress problem, not really a problem unique to the TCJA. So they're going to kick it back up by $50. So they're going to allow that higher contribution. Now, what if you've already taken the 50 out? Well, the IRS is now going to say, you know, you do have a right to roll, right? To roll between. But what if it's been more than 60 days? You find out about this more 6 days later. Well, they're going to say anytime up until essentially the due date for contributing to the HSA for 2018, which is into next year's due date for tax returns, you can put the $50 back in and it will be treated as remaining in the HSA. But there is one problem with that. Custodians are not required to allow you to put the money back in because the law says they don't have to allow for such anything except for the direct contributions. So what if you can't get it back in? Okay, or you just don't want to put it back in. Well, I got the $50, I spent it. I don't want to put my $50 back in. If you keep the $50, you know, there's a couple of things, right? If that happens, if you receive a distribution from the HSA of excess contributions based on the $6,850, you know, you basically can treat it as, you know, excess contributions. But what if, now it's more interesting, that was your employer's $6,900 that went in. It's been excluded from your W-2, but you took the $50 out. Now the IRS says, well, either that's going to be considered a distribution from your HSA because it was excluded from your income, and potentially subject to penalties unless you can show that, you know, you had medical expenses for which that was a reimbursement. If you can show that, you can basically get the $50 excluded from, you know, treat it as just a regular distribution from the HSA. Now, we'll see how picky the service is, because here's where the potential problem is. That's fine, except it's reimbursing you for expenses. Realistically, it would appear that expense should have been incurred before you got the $50. If you haven't really incurred medical expenses this year, but you already got the $50, that could be a problem. In any event, if you have a client with this situation, take a look at Revenue Procedure 2018-27. If you're a company that sponsors these sorts of plans, you want to take a look at that and let your employees know about, you know, how what the number really is, those who had family coverage, how this is going to work, because this obviously is a significant change. Now let's go on to taxing tips. This is a chief counsel advice, 2018-16-010, issued on April the 20th of 2018. And we're looking here at a unique and interesting situation. We're not told for sure what type of entity this is, but probably it is a not-for-profit organization like a museum, something of that sort. And they have volunteers who maybe are manning an information desk or, you know, collecting ticket costs, whatever, but they have volunteers doing work for them who are unpaid. At the front desk, there is a tip jar where people are allowed to put money in for tips for the people who are working. You know, the volunteers working here. At the end of each shift, the people that work that shift, the volunteers who work that shift, divide up the tip jar. Now the IRS has come in and they're examining this organization. Remember, these people are not on the payroll. And we're going to assume that legally they don't have to be. That's why I'm assuming a not-for-profit organization that is allowed to use volunteer workers. So, you know, they're not just telling people, sorry, you're not going to get a paycheck. You know, all you're going to get is whatever you can grub out of the tip jar. Well, they told the volunteers that, but they're allowed to tell them that. But the agent said, these still appear to fit the definition of what's tips. And I think they owe tips every quarter and they haven't been paying them. The chief counsel advice takes a look at this. And what the chief counsel advice determines is these really probably qualify as tips under the criteria we're going to find in Revenue Ruling 2012-18. In essence, we are voluntarily contributing money to them. You know, the payment was made free from compulsion. The customer had the unrestricted right to determine the amount. You decide what you're putting in or not. The payment would not be the subject of negotiation or dictated by the policy. So it's not one of those mandatory ads. And number four, and this is the one they discussed a little bit, the customer has a right to determine who receives the payment. The IRS notes that they have long taken the position that if you give to a general tip jar where the employees divide it up, that's considered you're giving to people on that shift. As such, you determined who gets it. As such, this meets all four criteria for this to be considered a tip in the view of the chief counsel advice. Now, the next question becomes, okay, well then, can we go after them for penalties? Because, you know, let's say that we're examining them and, you know, they've never included these people on their 941s, never included this as tips. So can't we go back, you know, and for all open years, and hopefully this organization had employees, so they've been filing 941s, but can't we go for all open years and then charge them penalties and interest for not paying these tips going back to that day? And the chief counsel advice says no. They're saying you can actually go and get the FICA all the way back for all the open years. That's not a problem. But because the employees are not reporting the tips to the employer, they didn't actually account for them to the employer. If they're not accounting for them under the way the rules work, the amount is not deemed due until the IRS issues notice and demand to the employer. So they owe all those tips, you know, all that FICA, which probably is going to be a bit of a pain for them, but they do not owe the penalties for having failed to pay that over for late payments and that sort of problem. It's now due. This is an interesting aside if you have an organization that uses volunteers and does, for whatever reason, offer a tip jar. You know, if they offer tips because maybe what they've got is volunteers who are, you know, serving food, you know, in essence. So they give them a tip jar. So you make a donation to the organization, you know, to get the food or whatever, you know, you're buying the food, whatever. But then there also is a tip jar there for the people working the bake sale or whatever. That's technically, in the IRS's view, FICA wages. Are they correct? Probably. Just be aware, especially if it's significant, that we have this position out there. Finally, let's take a look at the interesting case called of the case of the taxpayer who has a unique TurboTax problem. This is the case of Spottiswood versus United States. It was heard in U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. It is case number 3:17-CV00209. The opinion was issued on April the 24th of 2018. And here's the catch. Mr. Spottiswood, who, by the way, it turns out the tax due on his return was $400,000. So Mr. Spottiswood is not exactly your, you know, nice, poor little college student using TurboTax for his return. This is a fairly significant return because regardless of what you assume, even if he made no estimated payments, has no withholding, $400,000 is still going to mean there's a decent amount of income on that return. So Mr. Spottiswood apparently decided that per TurboTax, he could do this return himself. So he did. Now, all of us know that when you submit the return electronically, what he did, he submitted his federal return electronically because TurboTax would do that for free. But Mr. Spottiswood, you might expect he's a little bit, shall we say, frugal. He didn't want to pay somebody to do the return. So he's certainly not going to want to pay TurboTax additional money to file the California return electronically. He filed the California return on paper, but because he'd already paid TurboTax for the right to file the federal return electronically, he filed that one electronically. All of us in the business know the first thing you do once the return has been submitted is you're watching to get the acceptance back, or more importantly, looking for rejections, because you know if a rejection comes down, you have to move instantly. Well, not surprisingly, the same day his return was submitted, the IRS rejected it because he made a data entry error in keying in the ID number of his dependent. As such, the name didn't match. And so as such, the IRS bounced the return. TurboTax flags it in the software as saying, you know, your return has been bounced. If you go back in and check, it'll tell you. Plus, TurboTax sends an email to the email address you gave them telling you that the return has bounced. Mr. Spottiswood claimed that, well, they might have told him he's supposed to check that, but it was in, must have been the small print, and he didn't read it. So he wasn't aware that his federal return was not actually filed. And he said he had no idea there was this risk that they wouldn't accept the return once he hit the button for TurboTax. And he may very well not have had that noticed. But there was one other interesting thing he failed to notice as well. He owed 400 grand. He never noticed the 400 grand hadn't come out of his bank account. Or at least he claimed he never noticed it. Now, he claims there's lots of money in the account, and it was just, you know, that's why he didn't notice that 400 grand was still sitting there that shouldn't be. And I guess that's possible. But then that raises even better questions. If you're sitting on assets like that, why in the world are you doing your own return? You know, in essence, whatever you do to make money, you can probably do a lot better doing that and making the money for that time period rather than preparing the return. Paying the outside preparer is probably going to be a whole lot less than the time you just wasted doing it yourself. But hey, you know, whatever. He failed to notice it. Now, the other way to read that is, and a way that you might suspect may be true is, well, they never took the money out and they haven't complained. So I'm just going to wait and see if they say anything. Well, for some reason, we're not told why, but it wasn't until 18 months later that he discovered the return hadn't been accepted. And it wasn't because he fired up the TurboTax software from a couple of years back. He did finally do that after he noticed the problem. I don't know if he like noticed something cleaning out email, or if the IRS, you know, some question came in, some word came in, maybe he was trying to get a mortgage and couldn't get a copy of that return. Whatever reason, he noticed it 18 months later. Now, of course, the IRS says, well, thank you for your return. And thank you for the 400 grand. But oh, by the way, you owe us failure to file and failure to pay penalties. And because of that, you basically, you know, owe us these big penalties. He agreed on the failure to pay. You know, he's going to say he's not going to try to argue that it was reasonable for him not to have noticed 400 grand went away. Now, I'm not sure that that's a good news or bad news for him, because if you should have noticed that there wasn't 400 grand in your account, that probably means you should have inquired why it wasn't there. And as soon as you did so, you probably would have discovered the late filed return, you know, the return never been filed. Well, in any event, though, he tried to ask for relief on the return. He asked for a couple of rules. Number one, he said, well, look, this is all complicated. I'm not really a tax guy. I should have reasonable cause for not noticing that a return had not been filed. The court really didn't buy that theory. The court said, you know, he'd already admitted it wasn't reasonable that he hadn't noticed 400 grand being gone. And, you know, I think the court never explicitly says this, but obviously the jump is, if you would have noticed the 400 grand and you made any follow-up on it, you would have found out the return hadn't been filed. And, you know, finding that out might have been excusable, you know, your argument, the way I would view it, if, like, you know, a month later, you found out about this when you checked the bank, you did your bank recon, and then you did your inquiry, found the return had been filed. Maybe you got a shot at reasonable cause there, but 18 months later seems difficult. Also, and I think the court probably believes this, you decided to use this software, but you told us now that you didn't read the instructions. You didn't actually read how to do it. you know, you should know it's important to like pay attention when you're filing tax returns. You don't just vaguely throw numbers at it. So they didn't like that theory, but he had a second. He said, wait. If I had submitted this return on paper, the IRS would have accepted and processed it and never would have claimed that I failed to file my return, because effectively they had the information and they issued the reject notice and just ignored it. I shouldn't be hit with late filing penalties because I fit with the requirements of the Supreme Court's Beard, of the tax court's Beard opinion. And the Beard opinion that goes back to 1984, that was looking at statute of limitations issues and whether a document filed with the IRS had started the statute, which is not really quite the same question. But it said that a return would count to do the statute if the document is sufficient to calculate the tax liability, the document purports to be a return, the document evinces an honest and reasonable attempt to satisfy the requirements of the tax law, and the taxpayer executes the documents under penalties of perjury. A taxpayer said, I did all of that. My return meets all that criteria. Well, the court wasn't so thrilled about that either. The court said, basically, first thing is they said, well, you didn't really demonstrate this. You claimed they would have processed it on paper. What you gave us was parts of the Internal Revenue Manual. And these parts, looking at the dates that say they would process this return, they're all dated well after when you should have filed the return. So first thing is you didn't prove they would have processed it. So, you know, that theory is kind of gone. Number two, about this, that you filed a return that met all the requirements, they said no. The requirement of the return requires you to, you know, with electronic filing, is that you have to make sure you clear the acceptance process. And the fact that you ignored that, the return was rejected, so the court took the position it was not available for the IRS to compute the tax, therefore no return had been filed. Therefore, the court held you owe the failure to file penalty. In essence, both the failure to pay and failure to file penalties will apply to you in this case. As I say, it's May. You guys should have probably gotten your state society's catalogs if they're mailing them to you, or they're online on your locations if you want to go view them there. Now's the time to look through, figure out what you want to take this season. Remember, we have lots of changes from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that affect many areas of the tax laws. There's going to be tons of new material this year that you need to get up to speed on, and you need to get up to speed in a way that you actually retain the information. And one of the best ways to do that is to be in the classroom live, and your state societies are one of the few places these days where you can get it that way, live in the classroom. So you want to check your state society courses. We are going to be giving a bunch here. Kaplan Accounting Continuing Education is going to be doing a large number of courses around the country, both in accounting and auditing and tax. I'm going to be doing courses on the TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Like I said, I'm going to be a qualified business income here in the state of Arizona and in New Mexico here in May. And I'm going to be doing courses throughout the year on multi-state tax issues as we talk about what's happening with the questions involving the Wayfair case. And I'll be doing those in Arizona. I've got a session scheduled. I've got one session later in the year in Idaho that should be after we get Wayfair. So take a look right now. See what's there. Now's the time to plan. Now, for those of you, again, this has been the weekly update. You should know that regularly we post our updates on the website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can send your questions and comments about anything on this broadcast to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I do post on Twitter. I post whenever I post to the website. And I also post sometimes other information I run into related to tax. Find that at Ed Zollers. I may also basically retweet or like things that are related to tax matters. So, you know, maybe you like to follow that sort of thing. Also, you might follow discussions on the subreddit, which is www.reddit.com/r/taxpros. We discuss various items there relating to the tax law. So if you want to go over there, you can read there. You can also find me on both the California and Arizona listservs on the tax matters. So California's is Tax Talk, which is a Yahoo group that's really open to CPAs around the country. The Arizona Society is open to Arizona Society members, and so I keep track of those. So you can find me there. But in any event, another week's down. So Until next week, this is Ed Zoller saying I will be hoping you all have a good week and keeping up on what's happening here in the area of current federal tax developments.